All right, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, we're going to go ahead and get started here. We are starting a few minutes late. Had a little bit of a snafu there, but it looks like we're up and running. So you should have in front of you a set of notes for Lesson 103, Martin Luther and the German Bible, okay? So what you see there on the screen is, or on the board, I should say, is a title page from Luther's 1522, what's called the September Testament in German, all right? So you can kind of make some of it out. Das Testamentum New in Deutsch or German, and it was done in Nuremberg, okay? So we'll be talking more about that as we get started. So if you would, look at the introduction, if you would. Lessons 100, 101, and 102 have been devoted to a consideration of Erasmus and the Greek New Testament. In this lesson, we want to consider what happened when the Erasmian Greek text began to be translated into the vernacular languages of Europe. This was done for the first time in 1522 by the father of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther. Okay? Luther's German Bible not only solidified the Protestant notion of sola scriptura, it also served to establish the German language. In this lesson, we will cover the following points and subpoints. I want to look at first the German Bible before Luther, and then I want to look at Luther's German Bible in terms of the New Testament, the Old Testament, and then some of its interesting features, reaction, and response. And then we want to kind of look at the conclusion or some touch upon the impact of this. Okay? So that's kind of where we're going with this as we get started. So the first point, the German Bible before Luther. S.L. Greenslade is the editor of the Cambridge History of the Bible, the West from the Reformation to the present day. This third volume of the Cambridge History of the Bible contains an exceptional entry on Luther and the German Bible that discusses the state of the German Bible before Luther. He says, quote, "A German Bible printed by Solvin Otmar at Augsburg did indeed appear during 1518, only a few months after Luther published his theses." Okay, so if you think about what's going on here, Martin Luther, excuse me, deal with a bit of some allergies here. Martin Luther publishes his 95 theses in 1517. And nails them to the door of the church at Wittenberg, objecting the sale of indulgences. Okay, that happens shortly thereafter in 1518. There is a translation that does appear in German. So if you go back to the notes, okay, only a few months after Luther had published his theses. But it belonged to a series of editions of the German translation made in about 1350 and first printed in 1466 by Johann Metlin of Strasbourg. In the next 50 years or so, there were 13 further editions. This translation was not made from the original languages, but from the Vulgate, and was moreover, despite several revisions, especially in 1475 and 1483, clumsy in its linguistic form and partly incomprehensible. Okay? So this edition that shows up, this German Bible that shows up in 1518, shortly after Luther publishes his 95 theses in 1517, this is a sort of a reprint of some stuff that had been done very, very much earlier than that, okay, that had been taken from Latin. It had been translated into Latin, into German. It wasn't very good. It was clumsily done, and in some spots it was totally incomprehensible, even in German. Hence, it answered neither of Luther's two requirements for such a translation, that it should be based on the original text and should use a German comprehensible to all, and is not surprising that this medieval version did not have Luther's approval. So Luther publishes the 95 Theses in 1517. There is a German Bible available in 1518. It's a translation from Latin done in the medieval period in the 1300s, 1350, and published on a printing press in 1466. But it's not very good, it's not very comprehensible or understandable, and so Luther is not going to accept it as sort of fulfilling the need that existed during the Reformation for a Bible in German. Before the early 1520s, Luther had already utilized the Greek text of Erasmus in some of his teaching and preaching. Quote, He, Luther, had already used the Greek original in his lectures on Romans in 1515 through 1516, and the Hebrew in his commentary on Hebrews in 1517 and 1518. And since it was one of his cardinal principles that the scriptures were the only key to the faith, it is not surprising either that he decided to translate the Bible into German himself. It seems as if the idea of such a translation was already current in Wittenberg in 1520. So Luther's principles of the Bible being available to the people and it being the only source of Christian authority and doctrine are going to lead him to not accept this previously done German Bible that had been done based upon the Latin Vulgate. And so he is going to move to do this himself ultimately. Okay? So there was a German Bible before Luther. It was done from Latin. It wasn't very good. And Luther is not accepting it and thinks it needs to be done from the original language, from Greek and Hebrew, into a German that the average German speaker can read and understand. Okay? So are there any questions about the first point? All right. So Luther's German Bible. Alistair McGrath, author of Christianity's Dangerous Idea, The Protestant Revolution, A History from the 16th Century to the 21st, states the following about Luther's use of both German and Latin. He says, quote, in 1520, Luther took the decisive step that would lead to the fledgling Reformation breaking free from the limited confines of academia and becoming a popular movement. He began writing works in German rather than the more scholarly Latin. This is an important point, okay? When Luther publishes his 95 Theses, he did so in what language? He did so in Latin, okay? He attached them to the door of the church, intending for it to be an academic debate amongst the professors of the university regarding the merits of the sale of indulgences, okay? What happens, though, is somebody removes those from the door of the church, takes them to the printer, translates them into German, and publishes thousands of them that then spread all through Germany. And before you know it, what is happening to the sale of indulgences in Germany? It goes like down, like two-thirds of the normal take show up within 3 months of the publication of this, okay? So Luther is going to then start to speak directly to the German people by writing in German instead of Latin, and he starts that in 1520. Next paragraph. Luther would continue to use Latin when it suited him. After all, he wanted his ideas to travel throughout Europe, and Latin was the cosmopolitan language of his day. Yet Latin was a language of exclusion, which ensured that common people could not share in the political and religious discussions of the elite. Luther chose the most accessible and inclusive language of the region to reinforce his message of reform. So understand, if Luther wants to speak to academia and the church, is he perfectly capable and willing to write in Latin? Yes. If he wants to speak to the everyday common German, what language is he going to write in? He's going to write in German, okay? The publication of the appeal to the German nobility in 1520 stated that the laity should have the right to read and interpret the Bible for themselves. Making the Bible available in the German language thus became a priority. Luther urged that the medieval church had built walls around the Bible in an attempt to exclude ordinary Christians from reading and interpreting it. Now, when he says that, what's he talking about? He's talking about the medieval practice of the Roman Catholic Church confining the Bible to what language? Latin, and refusing it to be allowed to be translated. Now remember, have we already seen this when we looked at John Wycliffe? Okay, remember John Wycliffe moved to translate the Bible and the church stood against that. Could somebody locate a tissue for me if you would please? So, look at the next point, the New Testament. Now, my point in this lesson is not to teach all the history of Luther. Okay? It's just to focus on the Bible itself, right? His German Bible. If you want all the history about Luther, you could get it in the Grace History Project, or you could get it from the conference that we did in 2017 on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Thank you. Excuse me for a second. Huh. Pardon me. I have allergies, and they're kind of bothering me today, so I apologize. So in the story of Luther, I'm going to give you the real quick rundown of it, okay? Remember that he is captured and kidnapped by Prince Frederick to save his life, right? And then Prince Frederick hides him away in Wartburg Castle, living under an assumed name, right? And he's kidnapped and nabbed by his friends so that he can not, to escape the Catholic Inquisition that is looking to kidnap Luther on his way back from his trial at Worms, back to Wittenberg, okay? So he's captured by his friends. He's in Wartburg Castle, and this is where this picks it up here, okay? While in Wartburg, Luther began making his landmark translation of the New Testament into German, thus implementing his own demand that God's word be made available to all people. So, what better time to do this when he's got nothing else to do, right? I mean, is he free at this time to just go around Germany and preach and do whatever he wants? No, his very life is in danger and he's in hiding to try to protect that. So he tries to use that time wisely, and that's when he starts to translate the Bible into German. During his 10-month confinement at Wartburg, Martin Luther, with pen in hand, translated the New Testament into the German language of the common people from Erasmus's 1519 second edition of the Greek New Testament. So here's why I spent so much time on Erasmus. Luther is going to translate the second edition of the Greek New Testament of Erasmus into the German language. After being reviewed by his associate, Melanchthon, Luther published his German Bible in 1522. Regarding this pivotal event, Eric Metaxas states the following in his recently published book, Martin Luther, the Man Who Rediscovered God and Changed the World. He says, quote, "Without question, the largest of the projects Luther faced was translating the entirety of the Bible into German. The manuscript of the New Testament translation that he brought back from Wartburg in early March was breathtakingly impressive, although not quite finished. Luther knew that it still required the close and rigorous attention of Melanchthon." Now, Melanchthon is Luther's right-hand man, as it were, okay? He is arguably, outside of Erasmus, the most knowledgeable person in all of Europe on the Greek language. Okay? So he is going to go through the translation, sort of, to look it over. The linguistic savant, that's referring to Melanchthon, knew the Greek better than anyone alive, and now spent many weeks carefully combing through the text for nits, which he and Luther picked out. So Luther does the bulk of it while in his 10-month his 10-month confinement in Wartburg because of his safety, as far as his safety is concerned. Then when he comes back out of hiding, he's got this with him, and he and Melanchthon sort through it to pick out anything that needed to be sort of fixed. Returning from Wartburg to Wittenberg on March 6, 1522, Luther and his associates battled the clock in their efforts to complete the publication of the Bible by September in time for the Frankfurt Fair. We don't need to have September in there twice, okay? Because of these realities, Luther's 1522 New Testament is commonly called the September Testament. Regarding these circumstances, Andrew Pettigrew, author of Brand Luther, states the following. The Frankfurt Fair was by this time Europe's principal emporium for the wholesale trade in books, dwarfing the other major seasonal fairs established over the course of the previous centuries. It took place twice a year, at Easter and in September, and it was attended by publishers and booksellers from all of Europe's major book markets. A good sale at Frankfurt was considered critical, since it had been decided that the September Testament should be published in a huge edition of some 3,000 copies. So understand, Are they thinking about this also from the point of view of it being a commercial success? Okay? Is there a lot of money that's going to be tied up in the publication of the New Testament in German? So are the printers going to want to make their money back from the initial layout and investment that they've got into this, right? So Luther comes out of hiding in March 1522. They have the goal of having it in print and ready to be sold at the Frankfurt Book Fair by September 1522. Okay, they obviously are able to meet the goal, which is why it becomes known as the September Testament. Okay, Early copies were sent to Luther's friends and supporters, including Spalatin and Prince Frederick the Wise. When the work was made available to the public, it could not be kept in print. Quote, 3,000 copies were initially printed, all of which sold quickly. The second printing of an additional 2,000 copies occurred in December. But the popularity of this epical and groundbreaking book was so extreme that 3 months after the second printing, all copies had been sold, at which point the price going forward was tripled. Okay? So, what do you take from that? What I take from that is that the German people are starving to have the Bible available in their language. Okay? And once the Bible becomes available in their language, they're then able to make sure that it gets sold far and wide throughout Europe. Okay? Any questions about that? So I know this thing goes into hibernation here if I don't constantly mess with it. But this, I found on the internet and downloaded a reproduction, an exact photostatic reproduction of a 1522 September Testament of Luther, okay? I've got to wait for it to cycle back through and load. I might even have to log back in. But I want you to kind of look at, you can kind of look at what it looked like. That should cycle back there in a second. Let's go on. There it is. So this is the beginning of Matthew's gospel. Okay, obviously this is all German. You're probably not going to be able to read much of it, if anything. But notice the wood blocking and the drop caps here that are on the first line of each book. Notice that he's got marginal notes and explanations also in the margin here. So I'll show you more about that here after a while, okay? That Luther had doubts regarding the canonicity of James and Revelation is well known. The first edition of his Bible from 1522 has famously called the Book of James an epistle of straw. Now, how many of you are familiar with that? I've talked about this before, right? Why do they call James an epistle of straw? Luther had a hard time with the passages in James where it talks about a man being justified by what? By works, right? Reconciling that with what Paul said in Romans about a man being justified by faith apart from what? Apart from works, okay? So some of Luther's personal beliefs and misgivings show up in his September Testament in certain ways. This is one of them, famously calling James an epistle of straw. While later editions removed this statement, it was clear that Luther viewed certain New Testament books as setting forth the quote, the kernel and marrow of the gospel. And at the end of the New Testament, he wrote, quote, John's gospel and St. Paul's epistles, especially that to the Romans and St. Peter's first epistle, are the true kernel and marrow of all of the books. They ought properly to be the foremost books, and it would be advisable for every Christian to read them first and most, and by daily reading to make them as much his own as his daily bread. For in them you do not find many works and miracles of Christ described, but you do find described in masterly fashion how faith in Christ overcomes sin, death and hell, gives life, righteousness, and salvation. That's the note that he has at the end of the New Testament. Okay? It's interesting to think about what Luther's saying here. He's focused most on, he's basically admonishing the reader to focus most on the first epistle of Peter and the epistles of who? Paul. And Paul, most notably, which book?
Romans.
Okay? So it's interesting to think about it in those terms, okay? So, where am I at here?
Luther's
placement of Hebrews. We're on page three, guys. We're on page three, yeah. Luther's placement of Hebrews, James, Jude, and Revelation in his Bible speaks to his misgivings regarding their canonical status. It says, quote, as for the sequence of the biblical books, Luther followed Erasmus and not the Vulgate or the old German version in the New Testament, in that Acts follows the Gospels, not Hebrews, and the apocryphal epistle to the Laodiceans is left out. Now, this is interesting. If you think about your New Testament, you go Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and then what?
Acts.
Okay? Luther follows that sequence in his German Bible. And the reason he does that is he's following Erasmus. Erasmus had Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts. The Latin Vulgate had Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Hebrews. Okay? So he's changing the order there, and he's leaving out the epistle to the Laodiceans, which is considered apocryphal or non-canonical, right? But he placed Hebrews and the epistle of James together with Jude and Revelation at the end of the New Testament instead of before 1 Peter as non-apostolic writings did not give them numbers in the table of contents. So there he's not numbering them with the rest of the books in the table of contents because he doubts their what? He doubts their authenticity for theological reasons, okay? So again, it's not my point right now to get into all of the totality of explaining all Luther's theology and doctrine. We've done that in other places. Right now, I just want to focus on what happened with his German Bible. Placing God's word into the German language for the first time was not without its challenges. This is interesting, and you really need to think about this, okay? Luther also required extraordinary help with the very end of the book. In fact, it was the penmanship chapter of the ultimate book, Revelation, so that's the last chapter, that he needed assistance. In that chapter, the New Jerusalem is described as having foundations covered with every kind of jewel. Why don't you just go there quick? Just go in Revelation, just kind of see what this is talking about here. Go to Revelation. Where is chapter 21? Chapter 21, verse 10. Okay? Chapter 21, verse 10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the heavenly Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, and having the glory of God. And her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal, and it had great and high had 12 gates, and the gates 12 angels, and the names were written thereon. Okay, he goes down through here. Where does he start talking about the stones?
19,
thank you. And the foundations of the wall in the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third, I don't even know how to pronounce that in English. Chalcedony. The fourth an emerald, the fifth a sardix, the sixth a sardis, the seventh a chrysolite, the eighth a beryl, the ninth a topaz. Now, am I having trouble in English? Now imagine that never existing before in German. And now you have to literally figure out what words to put there in German to describe what is being discussed here by John in Revelation 22 and 21. So can he read it in the Erasmian Greek? Yes. So let's go back to the notes, top page 4. But how in the world to figure out the German word equivalents of such rare gems? Okay? For this conundrum, now this is fascinating. For this conundrum, he turned to his friend Lucas Caranche, who was creating 21 original illuminations, which were heavily influenced by Dürer. That's a famous German artist, okay, for the book of Revelation, which would be published with the New Testament itself. I'll show you a few of those in here in a second. Caranche, in turn, appealed to his friend Frederick, asking whether he and Luther could borrow some of the gems from his treasury, which they did, enabling them to identify each one by one. This is interesting, right? So is Luther doing something that's never been done before? Is he translating into German out of Greek? He encounters this passage. He doesn't know what half this stuff is. So through some connections, he encounters a friend that actually has some of these stones. And he goes there and they handle them and they look at them and they check them out. And from there, are they putting it into German? Okay, it's just really interesting when you think about that. On that topic, if I can wake this thing up again. On that topic, I want to show you a few of these illuminations from the book of Revelation. Okay, so what I did here is I just selected a few pages that I want to show you. There's the title page to the book of Romans from Luther's German Bible. So you can see, you know, you can make that out at least in English, right? That's Romans. So that's Romans chapter 1. This is Paul, a woodcut drop cap of Paul. And then when you get to the book of Revelation, there are 17 illuminations in Revelation, full page woodcuts of trying to depict certain scenes from the book of Revelation. Okay, so what we just read there about these artists trying to come up with and trying to understand what's going on, this is what we were reading about, right? So there's tons of these. So this is Revelation 13. When the beast ascends up out of the pit and the locusts come out, right? So here's the drawing that they actually put together back in 1522 to put into Luther's German Bible to illustrate for people what they were reading, okay? And I think that the reason they're doing this is because these people have never read the Bible before in their own tongue, right? And they're going to be like, what in the world's going on? Locusts coming out of a pit and smoke and fire, what? Right? So they include stuff like this. I don't have all 17 of them, and I'm probably not going to go through every single one of them with you, but they are certainly trying to depict different scenes from the book of Revelation, okay? So definitely interesting to look at there. I can show you more on that maybe later if you're interested in that. Okay. So regarding the popularity of the September Testament, Pettigrew writes, quote, Luther's September Testament was the first of more than 443 whole or partial editions of the Bible that would appear between 1522 and Luther's death in 1546. It swiftly became a mainstay of the printing industry in German, a text so popular that it would justify repeated reprints in all of the major places, publishing Luther's words and others besides. Okay? So any questions or comments about the New Testament? I'm doing a poor job of it, but I'm trying to impress upon you the fact that this literally had never what? Been done. And here it's being done. It's selling like hotcakes, and they can't keep it in print because the German people are just so starved to have the Word of God in their what? Next week we're going to start talking about William Tyndale and what he does for the English language, okay? But it's fascinating to me that, you know, these guys are willing to risk life and limb to have the Bible in their language. And today the Bible is literally everywhere and no one pays attention to it. It's on your phone, it's on your computer, you probably have 10 copies in your house, you know, and not saying you folks, but people in large, the Bible's everywhere and easily accessible, but nobody's what? Nobody's reading it, nobody's studying it, nobody's paying attention to it, okay? It wasn't that way back here. These people wanted it more than anything else, really.
I think it also kind of shows the defect for Luther wants to be accurate. Because, I mean, to go to such extremes as to find an actual, you know, stone to try to figure out, you know, how you can translate it. I mean, he just didn't take it for granted that this is what it's going to mean. He wanted the truth.
And from what I could gather, Lolly, what he really does at first is he kind of names them by color. Because you think about all those stones there, at least the ones I'm familiar with, they all have different what?
Color.
They all have different colors and stuff like that, right? So he's trying his best to get an awareness of things that he doesn't understand so that he can accurately communicate those things in his language, okay? Any other questions? All right, let's move on then to the next subpoint, which is the Old Testament. Regarding Luther's work on the Old Testament, Metaxas records the following. He says, quote, despite all else he was doing, Luther's greater and far more ambitious project of translating the entire Bible into German would not lie fallow. Even in 1522, not long after handing his New Testament manuscript to Melanchthon, Luther sprang into his years-long project. His plan was to attack it from the beginning books first and publish it in stages. The Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy would naturally be the first part. Okay? Now, I want to say something about this. The way people used to sell and buy books, it was customary for them to be sold and done by subscription or in serial form, right? If Luther's going to wait until he has the whole Old Testament done, is he going to be waiting a long time? Mm-hmm. Yes. So what he selects instead is to do smaller portions of it, and when those portions are done, have those printed and made available. Okay? So that's kind of the strategy that he's using here. Okay? Luther and his team, consisting of Melanchthon, Amsfurt, and others, got through these five long books with such speed that they were able to nearly finish the first volume of the Old Testament in late December of that year and actually publish it in February 1523. Okay? So, 1522, we have the New Testament published. This is what's called the September Testament. Then when is the Old Testament Pentateuch published? 1523 is published in February, the first five what? First five books, right? So I'm just going to say the Pentateuch is published in 1523. So is he moving quite fast through that portion of it? All right. Now he's not going to be able to ultimately sustain that pace. Okay, but translating from Hebrew presented fresh and sometimes extraordinary difficulties. For one thing, the Latin Vulgate was riddled with errors, which Luther was thrilled to discover and correct, although knowing they had been promulgated by the church for centuries must have caused him pain too. In a letter to Spalatin, Luther rather desperately asked help from him in solving the riddle of many obscure animal names found in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. By the time of his letter, the manuscripts were essentially finished, but before it could go to print, there remained a handful of sticky taxonomic wickets that needed to be negotiated. One can only imagine what Spalatin thought in reading this letter and in being urgently tasked with these overwhelming details. So this is quoting now from the letter. Luther said, please make your help available to us and describe for us the following animals, classifying them by their species. Birds of prey, nit, vulture, hawk, sparrowhawk, the male sparrowhawk, game animals, gazelle. I don't even know what some of these are, okay? Wild goat or forest goat, reptiles. Is stelio correctly translated as salamander? And whatever that means, as orange speckled toad. Among the Hebrews, Latins, and Greeks, the names of these animals are terribly confused, so that we have to guess at what they are on the basis of the genus and species of the animals. If possible, therefore, I want to know the names, species, and nature of all birds of prey, game animals, and venomous reptiles in German. Oh, just take your time on that. I need it as quick as you can, though. Okay? I don't know what the Vulgate was thinking when it mentions among the kosher animals the goat, stag, antelope, and giraffe. I wish that I would undertake this part of the work. Take the Hebrew Bible and try to find out all of these animals through careful research so that we can be sure about these things. And then he says, I do not have so much time. Okay? So again, you can see what they're dealing with here, right? I mean, they got these things they need to translate. There's all of these animals, and they're trying to figure out how do we say this stuff accurately in what language? German. Okay? In terms of the Old Testament project, Pettigrew paints the following picture in Brand Luther. He says, quote, Through all this sound and fury, Luther and his brain trust, worked steadily on it with the translation of the Old Testament. At first, this progressed well enough. Luther and Melanchthon moved smoothly through the Pentateuch, which was read for Lotter, the printer by the end of 1522, and thus convincingly occupied the press once the second edition of the New Testament was finished. Luther, ever mindful of the pockets of the potential purchaser, had always intended that the Old Testament would be published in three parts. This was helpful to publishers. It gave them three manageable projects with separate sales, and purchasers could then bind together the whole work when it was finished. In any event, this would take much longer than expected. Joshua to Esther was ready by the end of 1523 to be published in the following year. But then progress slowed dramatically. Because Job had occupied much more time than Luther had expected, the poetic books, Job to Song of Songs, were issued as a separate fascicule in the autumn of 1524. So the bottom line is, are they able to keep up their pace?
No.
Eventually, the project just gets to be so difficult that they have to slow down. Okay. Then other responsibilities intervened. In 1525 and 1526, Luther's attention was entirely taken up by the fallout from the Peasants' War and the dispute with Erasmus. Then in 1527, the university moved to Jena because of an outbreak of plague. So then there's disease outbreak that they got to deal with. Although Luther and Bungemann both remained in Wittenberg, the work of the prophets could not be continued in the absence of Melanchthon. This was doubly frustrating because Luther had in fact prepared a translation of the prophets from his lectures in 1524. Because it was now obvious that this section of the book would not be finished immediately, Isaiah was released for separate publication in 1528. So if you're tracking with it now, by 1528, have they released the New Testament?
Yep.
Yeah. Have they released the Pentateuch?
Yes.
Have they released Job to Song of Songs?
Yes.
Okay? And they've also released Isaiah in a standalone because of all the difficulties that are going on here with trying to get this done. Okay? The years 1529 to 1530 brought new difficulties. Thanks to Melanchthon's renewed absence at the Diet of Speyer and then at the Diet of Augsburg. Now I want to stop there for a minute. Those are church meetings that were held, especially the Diet of Augsburg, where the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles IV or V, was going to possibly shut down all of Protestantism within German kingdoms. Okay? It's at that meeting that led by Melanchthon that the Lutheran princes were able to read their own creed and force open the door of religious tolerance in the German territories as an official government action. Okay? From then on, what they did was it basically went, whatever the religion was of the prince of a given region would be the religion of that region. Okay? So imagine Michigan by county. We're not right now in Kent County, right? Let's say there was a prince of Kent County who was Catholic. That meant that everybody living in his domain would be what?
Catholic.
If you didn't want to be Catholic, you would have to what?
Move.
Right? So now let's say you have Ottawa County and the prince of Ottawa County was a Lutheran. If you were a Catholic living in that territory, you would have to what? Move. But this is still a breakthrough in that. The emperor is at least allowing the religion of the prince to determine the religion of the domain of his jurisdiction. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Melanchthon is sent to those meetings in Luther's stead because there is still concern about what would happen to Luther if he left the safety of where he was. Okay, if he goes out traveling, there's still a lot of concern that something might happen to him. So Luther sends Melanchthon to these meetings to represent their sort of side of the argument. Okay, is that making sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So all of that then is going to mean that the work on the translation is what? slowed way down, right? Because Melanchthon is sort of the linguistic guru who knows the most about what's going on with the languages.
So in his absence, they can't really do much.
Luther poured out his frustrations by translating the book of Daniel.
Wouldn't it be nice to just, when you get really mad, translate Daniel? it's so easy, okay?
In apocalyptic mood after his work with Daniel's prophecies, he now wondered if the end of the world would come before the Bible translation was finished. So he's reading about all the stuff going on in Daniel, right? Daniel 8, Daniel 9, all that stuff about, you know, the prophecies there about the 70 weeks and the end of the world and all this sort of thing. And now Luther's like, well, maybe we won't get this finished before the world ends, right? Only in 1532 had he and Melanchthon managed to find time to sign off on the prophets, now published once again as a separate volume. That left only the Apocrypha, never Luther's favorite. This he prepared to delegate largely to Melanchthon and Justus Jonas. Their task was completed finally in 1534, clearing the way for the much-delayed complete Wittenberg Bible. Okay? So that happens in 1534. That's almost 10 years after more than 10 years after he does the first September what? New Testament, right? So this is a lengthy process of time to get the whole Bible into German. In 1534, Luther published the entire Bible in German for the first time, the culmination of more than 12 years of labor. All right, so before we get to the next sub-point, does anybody have any questions or comments? No? Okay. Features, reaction, and response. Metaxas reports that Luther's German Bible was a masterpiece of the bookmaker's art. Quote, in large part because of Luther's extensive clarifying commentary and marginal notes. Now, did I show you that? I'm not going to wake this up again, but did I show you the marginal notes up there?
Yeah.
Okay. It can hardly be seen by us as it was first seen. Now, this is an interesting point. Are we used to seeing Bibles? First of all, are we used to seeing Bibles in our language?
Yeah.
I have a Schofield Reference Bible here. Am I used to seeing Bibles with marginal notes and all sorts of stuff going on?
Yeah.
I'm used to it, right? But imagine you've never seen a Bible in your language, and then you have the text and you got all the stuff in the margin trying to explain the text. Okay? So this is the point he's trying to get at here. Okay? It can hardly be seen by us as it was first seen, because thanks to Luther, so many today are familiar with the Bible and what it is. But if we imagine a population that had never seen the Bible in a language they could read and had no idea of what was in the book, we may understand it as a revelation to almost all who first saw it, and not less than historic and even and indeed revolutionary. Luther's commentary prefaces in front of each book were for many Germans the very first explanation they had of what was in this book that had been for centuries hidden from them. So imagine just a short blurb at the beginning of the book of Romans about Rome, Paul writing to the church at Rome, maybe when it might have been written, and just a few things, right? Have they ever even thought about that a day in their life? Never. Okay? There are innumerable examples of simple clarifying explanations that would have forever changed how people viewed things. In the beginning of the New Testament, for example, Luther explains the meaning of the word gospel as good news. He explains that although the four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are the stories of Jesus' life, crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension, nonetheless, the actual true gospel is to be found all through the New Testament. The whole of the story is the what? Gospel. Okay? Now, I don't know if I totally agree with all of Luther's thinking there, but is he trying to explain to people what they're going to read?
Yeah.
Okay? According to Metaxas, the following factors contributed to Luther's New Testament becoming a powerful sensation. For one thing, its language was powerful. Many phrases were so good that they entered the German language forever. Luther did not write a book to read so much as a book to read aloud. It was deftly attended to the ears of the average German, and this would give it wings and legs both. So in other words, we've kind of talked about this with the King James Bible already, right? Luther wrote this in such a way so how it would sound when it was read how?
Out loud.
Okay. But more than the translation's excellence were the prefaces which helped explain and frame everything. Of course, this idea was itself central to Scripture, that the Scriptures could not be understood unless someone explained them to us. It is often overstated that Luther opened the Bible. It is often overstated that Luther opened the Bible for everyone to read, because this implies that all interpretations of it are equal, which Luther clearly did not believe. He set himself up as a guide and teacher and knew that there was not a substitute for this any more than there was a substitute for people reading the Bible on their own. He had no difficulty in seeing that either one taken to an extreme would create grave problems. So in other words, is Luther trying to walk the line between the necessity of the individual Christian to read the Bible for him or herself versus him being the one that's just telling everybody what everything means?
Yes.
Okay? Anyone reading the Bible without an understanding of what he read was certain to fall into error, just as anyone who refused to read the Bible and only allowed others to interpret it made it possible that he would be listening to interpreters who were theologically wrong. So again, is there a line there that Luther is trying to establish? Okay. Just as no one can die for us, no one can have a relationship with God for us, and therefore no one can take full responsibility for how we read the Scriptures. At some point, we have personal responsibility. We have personal responsibility to be involved. So all of Luther's commentaries were meant to be helpful, but none of them were meant to be exhaustive or definitive. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Where are we at here? Okay. Church historian Edward Miller also heaps high praise upon Luther's translation. Even the papal historian, Manabog, is how I would say it, confesses that Luther's translation was remarkably elegant and in general so much approved that it was read by almost everybody throughout Germany. Now here's the statement. It was a national what? If you were a German Christian, what were you reading? You were reading the Bible. Okay? It was the book of the people. The book of God. This work served more than all Luther's writings to the spread and consolidation of the Reformed doctrines. The Reformation was now placed on its own proper foundation, the Word of God, which liveth and abideth forever. The following statistics show the wonderful success of the work. A second edition appeared in the month of December, and by 1523, 17 editions had been printed at Wittenberg, 13 at Augsburg, and 12 at Bessel, one at Erfurt, one at Grimma, and one at Leipzig, and 13 in Strasbourg. In roughly a year is how many are being printed. Okay? So, before we get to the conclusion, does anybody have any questions?
Why did he have 17 editions? Was he making changes?
No, those are 17 printed editions.
Not separate printed.
Yes, yeah, so let's say I write a book tomorrow about this class today. And it's printed. That's the first edition. And then that sells out, and then I print it again. That would be a second edition. And then that sells out, and then that would be the third, and so on and so forth.
I see. Okay.
Not necessarily revised editions.
Okay. Could they be revised? Were they?
Some of them might have been. My sense of that is more that his focus was much higher on getting the whole Bible done with the Old and the New Testament than it was
going back over the new and revising it right away.
That makes sense.
Okay, I think that was his main focus. So conclusion and impact. Luther's formally equivalent translation of the Erasmus Greek New Testament is the first complete Bible translation from the original languages into a modern vernacular language of Europe. Luther's German Bible served as the source for the following vernacular translations. Okay? 1523, the Dutch. 1524, Danish. I don't know the exact year there on the Swedish. Lolly, you might be able to find that out for me. Since you're from Sweden, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would. If you can find out, I'd certainly like to know. 1540, the Icelandic. 1541, Hungarian. 1562, Croatian. 1584, the Hebrew New Testament was used for a missionary work among the Jews of Slovenia. Okay? So here's the thing. Once this happens, and this is why I'm spending so much time on this. Once this happens, does this let the Reformation cat completely out of the bag? Is the Roman Church going to be able to stuff it back in and keep everybody in line anymore?
No, never.
Not again. Because of the now accessibility that people are going to have. Now, I left out Tyndale there because we're going to talk about Tyndale a lot. Metaxas comments upon the technology of the printing press applied to the printing of the vernacular language Bibles spearheaded how... I messed that up. Metaxas comments upon how the technology of the printing press applied to the printing of vernacular language Bibles spearheaded the Reformation. He says, quote, "There is no question that Luther's future ability to have his own vernacular German translation of the Bible printed en masse would dramatically help him in the wider work of the Reformation that Wycliffe had hoped for in his own time." Now, you remember Wycliffe, right? All of his Bibles were copied by what?
Hand.
So now you see in the German Bible a couple things that we've been studying come to fruition, right? Number one, did the Renaissance humanists stress the vernacular languages? Yes. Did they reestablish a love and an interest in Greek? Yes. Did Erasmus as a humanist produce a Greek New Testament? Yes. So now what is Luther doing? Luther is using the Erasmus Greek New Testament to produce for the first time a Bible, a printed Bible in German that can be printed in en masse over and over and over and over again. And when that happens, it's going to look, folks, it's going to change the world is what it's going to do. Okay? Lastly, Luther's German Bible forever altered the German language. As for the significance of Luther's version, it is far more than a mere translation, for it does not adhere slavishly to the style and syntax structure of the originals, but is both wholly rendered into German and at the same time linguistically exact in detail. Luther's principles are set out in his preface to the Old Testament in 1523, in his letter on translation, and his summaries on the Psalms and on the grounds of translation. Luther's Bible was a literary event of the first magnitude, for it is the first work of art in German prose. Luther showed himself to be a poet of genius and with a true feeling for the properties of other languages, even though he was less of a scholar than his learned collaborators Melanchthon and Argilus. The Bible first became a real part of the literary heritage of the German people with Luther. He believed, contrary to the teachings of the Catholic Church, that the Holy Scriptures were the only true key to faith and doctrine, and his translation was the sure foundation of the Reformation. In the history of the language, his version is also a factor whose significance cannot be overestimated in the development and vocabulary of modern literary German. Okay? I've been trying to tell you this too for weeks. There is no greater impact on a language than when the Bible gets put into that language. It solidifies the language, and it creates a sense of national identity of the people group around that language. Okay? Imagine world history without a unified Germany. Can you even do that with me?
No.
Okay. Germany at this time was 1,000 small principalities. The Bible gets put into German. All these principalities, they spoke German. They could read it. But as they read it and they come to terms with it, does this create a unit? Does this unify all these German-speaking people together as Germans? Okay. You now come into the 19th century and Germany unifies under Bismarck. Then you go to the early 20th century and who's responsible, largely responsible for the two world wars? Now, I'm not trying to hang all the world wars on Luther's German Bible, but I'm trying to get you to see that when the Bible is put into the language, does it change the culture of the people? And it solidifies the language of those people and creates within them a shared national identity around their understanding of the language. So in the next lesson, we will begin looking at William Tyndale's translation of the Erasmian Greek into English. Okay? So that's the end of the lesson. If you go to the next page, you just have the works cited there, all the sources that I used to write the lesson. We have just a few minutes here. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah, Amy.
Back on page 4, there's a quote from the text that says, "For one thing, the Latin Vulgate was riddled with errors, which Luther was thrilled to discover and correct, although it only had been
promulgated
by the church for centuries." Okay, so what? The Latin Vulgate was riddled with errors, and he was thrilled to discover and correct. What? Have you already covered that?
Well, so Metaxas doesn't elaborate on what these errors are. So they could be anything from word order to flat-out mistakes, and he's saying it there, if my memory is not mistaken, in the context of these animals and all this stuff that you're on, it was page 4, right?
Yeah.
I think it's within the context of just misidentifying certain things, maybe not having all the animals quite right. He also mentions here that they had some animals that maybe technically were not clean, listed as kosher in the Latin Vulgate, stuff like that. And again, Metaxas doesn't elaborate any further on what the exact nature of those are, but I would think that's kind of what it probably would be, some of those types of details. Because this is what he's, on that same page in that letter, I mean, that's basically what Luther's complaining about. If you reread the very bottom of page 4, and then if you read the last paragraph, among Hebrews, Latins, and Greeks, the names of these animals are terribly confused, right? So this is all quoted from the same thing. So I think it's related to some of those types of things. If you go to top page 5, he says, "I don't know what the Vulgate is thinking when it mentions among the kosher animals, goat, stag, antelope, and giraffe." It's at least stuff like that. Okay, Mike?
The errors that Erasmus found were more serious, right?
Yes, the errors that Erasmus found are much more substantive type things. Okay, yeah, good question. All right, so here's what's going to happen. Next week we're going to start talking about Tyndale. We're going to do two lessons on the life and times of William Tyndale. Then I'm going to do a lesson on William the Translator. And we're just going to look at the nature of Tyndale's translation into English and really dig into why it was significant. And then what I'm probably going to do, guys, is I'm going to take three passages, one from the Old Testament and then two from the New Testament, and we're going to establish a working document where we look at, starting with Tyndale, how all the subsequent English translations then deal with certain passages so that you can see literally through time how the translations are progressing till you end up with the King James in 1611. Does that make sense? So that's kind of a lot, but that's kind of what I'm aiming to do, right? Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, why is this important?
Why is what important?
To understand the history are we studying this because we're trying to prove the infallibility of the Word of God, and how is that what's going on?
The main purpose of the class is to study the inspiration, preservation, transmission, and translation of Scripture.
Okay.
With the goal of really ultimately understanding why the King James Bible is, for an English-speaking person, the one that you want to be using.
Very good.
Offset and counter distinction to the critical text and all the modern versions that have come from that. You're walking into the middle of this is lesson 103, so there's a lot that we've done, and then we're funneling that all through then to other stuff. And then I ultimately want to get into how this text of the Reformation was undermined in the 19th century.
There's so many questions by young people that just look at it and say, it's not that, we don't have it. And I think this is why this